Love the planet? Then come to the 2009 Connecticut Folk Festival and Green Expo, September 11th through the 13th. This year, CT Folk expands its green-themed offerings with GreenWorks, a green job fair and symposium offered in partnership with Southern Connecticut State University. The Tour de Farms, another new addition to the festival, will take bike riders on a tour of local farms, orchards, and other agricultural treasures, serenaded by local musicians at each stop. The Green Expo returns to Edgerton Park with its One Planet, Many Choices theme, and a multitude of vendors offering solutions for saving while going green. The world stage at the Green Expo will offer a free family concert on the afternoon of Saturday, September 12th, featuring New Haven's own jazz folks, as well as workshops ranging from beekeeping and bugs, to face painting and storytelling, to an interactive art installation. The festival will conclude on Sunday, September 13th, at the Edgewood Park Farmers Market in New Haven with the Deva Hoot, an informal community sing-along. Celebrate the end of the outdoor music festival season at the 2009 Connecticut Folk Festival and Green Expo, September 11th through the 13th. Visit ctfolk.com for the lineup of artists and call 203-392-6154 and reserve your tickets today. Call 203-392-6154 or visit ctfolk.com. We'll see you there.
Sometimes I'm out of control. You're the only reason I keep on coming. You're the only reason I keep on coming. Yeah, you're the only reason.
Hi, my name is Bob Johnson, and I'm the program director at WPKN. If you're a longtime listener to the station, in the next few weeks you're going to be noticing some important changes both in our schedule and our format. You probably know that historically most of our air shifts have been 4 hours long, and starting this month that's going to change. From now on, most of our programs will be 3 hours in length. You might also find that some of your favorite WPKN programs have changed either the day or time when they are broadcast, or both. We've made these changes in an effort to make our programming sound fresher, allow more new programmers on the air, and to create a more cohesive sound. WPKN will remain the creative and free voice of non-commercial radio in southern New England. We will continue to work hard to provide you with a worthwhile and fun listening experience while better serving our community. In the days ahead, we will be refining our new schedule and also updating our online listening guide. If you have any questions about these changes or simply need to know where your favorite shows are on our new schedule, you can always feel free to call, write, or email. None of us at WPKN and WPKM forget for 1 minute that you are the reason we're here, and without you, we would not exist. Thanks.
Turn and face the strange. Changes. Don't tell them to blow up out of it. Turn and face the strange. Changes. Where the shame you've left us up to our next event.
This is WPKN Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. And just a quick note before we get started with today's program, and that is this. WPKN today has launched a new format, and you just heard Bob Johnson mention some of those changes. And just to review what those changes are, and includes the preceding program, This Way Out, being moved to another spot. This program, Counterpoint, actually will remain in its current place, 8 to 10 p.m. And the other features mentioned by Bob just a few moments ago, three-hour shifts. There will be a 12 noon to 1 p.m. hour block, a one-hour block of public affairs programs. And Democracy Now! Will follow this show at 10 p.m. Free Speech Radio News has now moved from 6 p.m. in the evening to 11 p.m. at night, following a little later this evening. So just a quick personal note here. There's been some internal debate about this at the station, and some pro, some con. And personally, I very much like the idea of Democracy Now! Being on these airwaves, which has been a sort of a long wish of many listeners and people here at the station. So those are good things. And the one-hour slots on 12 noon to 1 is also, I think, a good change in the schedule. But my own personal view about removing virtually all public affairs and news programs from drive time, from the most accessible times on the airwaves, was, I think, a problem for the station's mission and likewise. But my likes and dislikes aside, and anyone here at the station's likes and dislikes aside, the main thing that I would like to emphasize before we get back to our regular show here at Counterpoint is to encourage you, the listeners, to give us your feedback, because after all, there is no station without you, our listeners. So we'd like to know what you think of the changes, and to that end, we've set up an email address where you can send your notes to, and it will reach the program director, the general manager, everybody on the board of directors, and will be made available to everyone here at the station. That email address is wpknfeedback@yahoo.com. wpknfeedback@yahoo.com. I'll mention a little later on tonight and be announcing it in other places during the schedule. But do send your email to that about what you like, don't like, or your ambivalence. Whatever it is, we'd like to hear from you because, as Bob said before, you count the most. A listener-sponsored station like ours is dependent on you. So these changes, hopefully, will be of benefit to you. So that's it. WPKNfeedback@yahoo.com, and we'll break now to go back to Counterpoint, which will be starting up in just a couple of moments. Stay tuned.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds, snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I am a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Sharon works as its own needs. Dummies of your own needs. Beat it up and not speak. The fury's beating down your neck. Team my team reporters, Babble Tom, Kevin Pratt, look at that, no plane, fine, then, uh-oh, overflow, population common, do what it'll do, save yourself, serve yourself, whoa, don't need, listen to your heartbeat, tell me which direction is the rabbit and the right, right, patriotic, slam, fight, bright, my feeling, pretty sight, it's the end of the world. Four towers, slice and burn, return. Listen to yourself, turn. Locking in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate. Automotive centering, light a candle, light a motor, step down, step down. Watch a heel crush, crush, uh-oh, this means no fear. Cavalier, renegade, steer clear. Tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
Good evening. Welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, here between 8 and 10 p.m. each Monday evening, and thank you for tuning in. We have, as usual, a packed list of guests. In a little while, we're going to be speaking with Maryland psychiatrist Carol Paris, a member of the group Physicians for a National Health Plan. And they're going to be talking about the health care reform debate on Capitol Hill, the likely compromises that are being made behind closed doors, and the results for all of us. Later tonight, Kim Ives will be here from the newspaper Haiti Liberté. We're going to be talking about the struggle for an increase in the minimum wage in Haiti and the student movement down there that's been burgeoning. A little later tonight, we'll be talking to an assistant counsel at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, and we're going to be discussing a federal district court decision that upheld the University of Texas at Austin's consideration of race in student admissions, certainly a lot larger issue than this one court case, and we'll be taking that up with her. But first, I'd like to welcome back an old friend of this program, Medea Benjamin. She's a co-founder of Code Pink and Global Exchange, and we're going to be talking about the peace movement and what they're up to regarding the what seems to be an escalating war in Afghanistan and elsewhere, a little bit about health care, too. Medea, thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me in.
Yeah, so I wanted to, first of all, have you tell our listeners a bit about Code Pink Women for Peace. You guys have been in the limelight very often at congressional and Senate hearings, political conventions, high visibility protests that have garnered much attention on social justice and peace issues that you've certainly been working on for many decades at Code Pink, as well as your work at Global Exchange. But tell our listeners a bit about the group.
Code Pink started before the war in Iraq with the idea that if we organized enough, we could stop the invasion from happening. And we've been organizing ever since. During those 8 bleak years of the Bush administration, we mobilized hundreds of thousands of people together with the Coalition United for Peace and Justice to protest not only the invasion of Iraq, but also the continuing war in Afghanistan and a lot of the issues like Guantanamo and civil liberties issues. And our mission is to push ordinary Americans to get involved in foreign policy issues and to try to switch our priorities from this bloated Pentagon budget to one that addresses the real security needs for education and healthcare and the environment.
So when we turn our attention to what's going on in Afghanistan, of course, there's been a lot of attention now with the recent election, which is seemingly day by day tainted ever more by accusations of vote rigging on the part of U.S. ally and incumbent President Hamid Karzai. But we just had a report today that was partially leaked. The chief general there in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, is calling for an overhaul of the war strategy. And he has said in the past that the situation is serious and deteriorating. But today in this summary of his larger report, he said success is achievable. A lot of news reports talk about a request from the Pentagon for likely 20,000 more troops there. What are some of your reactions to what's going on in Afghanistan right now?
I think the public is way ahead of the administration and Congress, in that the latest ABC Washington Post polls show that now a majority of Americans think that Afghanistan is not a war worth fighting. And when you lose that kind of public support, eventually the Congress and the administration are going to have to do what they did in the case of Iraq, which is to put forward an exit strategy with the time for withdrawal.
As far as what's at stake in Afghanistan, we have certainly been told since September 11, 2001, that the Taliban that the U.S. overthrew with the help of the Northern Alliance and other warlords harbored and gave safe passage to al-Qaeda that organized those attacks on this country. So you even had Barack Obama. As a candidate, President Barack Obama promised to focus more attention in Afghanistan because he maintained that that's where the danger to this country really lies, not the war in Iraq that President Bush initiated. Where do you see the Obama administration heading with this? There's a lot of concern about a quagmire like Vietnam, that continual escalation in a war that cannot be won militarily.
It certainly is. I mean, Obama has already sent an additional 20,000 troops to Afghanistan. The total of U.S. troops is now, well, will be 68,000 by the end of the year. There's about 100,000 troops that NATO has committed. And where is this all leading? The situation in Afghanistan is getting no better. As McChrystal will say, And to call for more troops is just like the case of Vietnam, widening the war without a real plan. And nobody can clearly articulate to the American people what it is we're even trying to do in Afghanistan. We've had other generals like Petraeus say that there is no military solution, that we should have an 80-20 formula where 80% is political and economic focus and 20% military, and yet they're just passing new supplemental bills for war in Afghanistan that are 95% military. So we're pursuing a military strategy when we should be putting money into the uplifting people out of poverty. If we want to protect anything, we should be protecting girls' schools, and there could be international peacekeepers that do that. But there is no military solution, and this could unfortunately be the unraveling of a progressive agenda.
Now, when it comes to civilian casualties in Afghanistan, you know, there's been a lot of reporting on the numbers of civilians killed by U.S. and NATO airstrikes, wedding parties, schools. I mean, there's all sorts of manner, all manner of accidental deaths of civilians at the hands of the U.S. and NATO that at first, you know, the U.S. seems to resist reporting them accurately. I don't know. It's a real mess there. And when it comes to the idea of negotiating with the Taliban, Medea, there's a lot of mixed feelings here and around the world. The Taliban, of course, were a very repressive regime when they were in power, repressing women particularly and those who didn't adhere to their brand of fundamental Islam. Do you think negotiating a political solution to the war in Afghanistan with the Taliban is a viable option?
I think there's different factions of the Taliban, just as there's different factions of the Democratic and Republican parties, and we have to have talks with the more moderate factions of the Taliban. Unfortunately, now we have all kinds of warlords and murderers and drug dealers that are within the government of Hamid Karzai, a very corrupt government, but also many regressive people in there who don't respect the rights of women, and they're part of the government we're supporting. We have to support women's organizations inside Afghanistan. We have to support girls' schools. We have to support economic projects that are aimed at women. There's all kinds of things that we can be doing to decrease the strength of the worst elements of the Taliban and increase the strength of the victims of the Taliban, such as women's rights. But doing it through a military bombing campaign and drones and the constant killing of civilians is only adding fuel to the fire, is only creating more recruits for the Taliban and even for Al-Qaeda, and is not going to end the cycle of violence.
Where is the U.S. peace movement in all this? It seems that since the election of Barack Obama, a lot of the opposition to Bush administration policies in both Iraq and Afghanistan have really seen a lower profile. Is it the fact that many in the peace movement see the Democrats as a better alternative to the previous Bush administration, therefore they're giving Barack Obama a pass here? What do you think?
There's a lot of different things going on, Scott. At the level of Congress, I think, yes, they're reluctant to take on the Obama administration, which still has a lot of popularity out there. Within the peace movement on the grassroots level, people are tired from so many years of protesting and organizing and mobilizing and vigils and rallies and phone calls and emails. It's exhausting. And they would like to trust Obama to do the right thing. In the case of Iraq, people are anxious that he stick to a timeline that he promised. And then there's economic factors as well. We've had a Code Pink House in D.C. that in the past has been overflowing with people coming to stay at the house and join us on our forays into the Capitol and at the White House to lobby for an end to the war. And now it's harder to get people because they have a difficult time finding the financial resources to come to Washington, D.C. If they have jobs, they're afraid to take time off from their jobs. So that has impacted us as well. So I think there's a combination of things. But I do feel that this is a time that we'll start seeing an upsurge in the movement against the escalation of the war in Afghanistan. Once you see public opinion turn around, and we've had now 6 months of the Obama administration, I think people are feeling a little more comfortable about challenging the administration's positions, particularly on Afghanistan.
So in your work at Code Pink, what are you planning on in the coming months, especially since an escalation of troops, a further escalation of U.S. troops into Afghanistan may be a real possibility?
We just came off of a West Coast retreat where we had about 100 people coming together to re-energize ourselves for the coming months. We have a very busy schedule in the fall. In September, we are designating a week of education and media focus around Afghanistan. We're organizing our delegation to go to Afghanistan at the end of the month to come back with stories, particularly from the women there. In October, we'll be almost an entire month of action, starting on October 5th and then going to mark the 8th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan. So both in Washington, D.C. and then in local communities, there'll be lots of activities to mark that date and to really push for a timeline and an exit strategy. And it is interesting that while there has been a resolution in the House calling for an exit strategy, there hasn't been until recently in the Senate. And just last week, we saw Senator Russ Feingold finally step forward and say that he was going to be calling for an exit strategy. So I think there'll be some movement in Congress, but hopefully a lot more movement on the grassroots that can push Obama on this issue.
You think he's pushable? Like I said before, he seemed to, you know, really stake his foreign policy and his military policy during the campaign on winning the fight in Afghanistan. As he put it, there was so much at stake there in terms of America's national security. You think he's movable?
I think that the definition of winning in Afghanistan can be a moving one. In that if Obama sees that the public has turned against this war and that there is that even sending more troops is not bringing about an end to the conflict, that we can move to push at least for an exit strategy, and that's something that's done in Congress. If we start getting more momentum there, if we do our work to push the local representatives to sign on for resolutions calling for a timeline and exit strategy, I think we could get the same kind of thing that he supported in Iraq to happen in Afghanistan.
We're speaking with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the groups Global Exchange and Code Pink Women for Peace. And Medea, what's your view of what's going on in Iraq right now? There seems to be a spike in the rise of violence there after many months of a decrease in the violence seen in the streets of Baghdad and across Iraq. The United States has a timetable to withdraw most of the troops by the end of 2011. Are you satisfied with that timetable, and do you have any concerns about the stability of the U.S. allied government there?
Well, I have concerns that no troops have come home yet, and we're waiting to see the brigades that Obama mentioned would start to come home. We're waiting still to see them. I think, unfortunately, there's going to be a lot more violence in Iraq with or without the troops there. There's many unresolved issues and issues that the United States has helped to foment that have led to this tremendous instability, both in terms of ethnic divisions as well as who's going to get access to the oil. Those things are still not worked out. So I don't think we can expect that suddenly all of these rifts will be mended. But it is interesting that there is talk within the parliament inside Iraq to have a vote, and that the U.S. is very worried that if there is a vote about should the U.S. troops stay until that 2011 in timeline, that the majority of Iraqis would vote for an earlier timeline for withdrawal of the troops. So I think one element to allowing the Iraqis to solve the problems themselves is to get those troops out of there.
Well, Medea, before we say goodnight, I wanted to get a few minutes of discussion on where you think the United States healthcare reform debate is headed. You've got certainly Code Pink and many other grassroots organizations involved. Although this particular month of August, we've seen a lot of attention on what you'd have to label as very successful organizing on the part of the right wing that have thrown up all sorts of misinformation about what health care reform is likely to lead to in terms of death panels and infanticide or whatever else they're screaming about at these town hall meetings across the country. But in the end, what do you see happening here, and what role do you think groups like yours, activist groups, are going to play in how this thing comes out?
I think, unfortunately, we've ceded a lot of the momentum to the right on this, because groups that should have been out there calling for Medicare for all, for single payer, were groups that had helped get Barack Obama into power and were taking their cues from the administration. And so that there was even a decision to drop from the debate the whole Medicare for all issue, and we started out the health care debate then with a very conservative position. And that, I think, was a huge mistake and will plague this whole health care reform to the end. I think we'll get something that is not very satisfactory to progressives at all, won't resemble much by way of reform. And the administration is left fighting now for a public option, where we could have been fighting for Medicare for all and, if necessary, have compromised to a public option. So I'm very disappointed with the way this debate was handled and the strategy that came from the White House. But I think it's still important for us to stick to our positions and try to move the debate more towards the center by staking out that position of Medicare for all. We continue to go to the rallies and the town hall meeting saying, what happened to Medicare for all? Why is it off the, who took it off the table and why? I think we should continue with that position throughout the fall.
I wanted to get your take on the success of these right-wing organizations. Some people call them AstroTurf groups because they're, at the bottom line, they're funded by some of the biggest corporations in the country that have something at stake with healthcare in terms of their profit motive. But they have succeeded in getting the media spotlight on them and, again, what comes to be known as a lot of misinformation. Why do you think they were so successful? And I might also get your response to some interviews I've heard on some of these cable TV news shows where they say, hey, you know, well, you know, Code Pink does these kind of demonstrations. Now we're doing them, too. They mentioned your group by name in the way to compare themselves with Code Pink in terms of, you know, the kind of nonviolent guerrilla-style action that is part and parcel of what you do.
Sure. Well, let me take each of those. I think that in terms of starting at the last one, we certainly don't come armed to any debates. We also try to use the forums to engage and stimulate the debate rather than to stop it. In town hall meetings, we actually have in the past gone and sometimes just held up our banners quietly to try to get the congressperson to address the issue and certainly ask questions wherever we can. We interrupt when no one will allow us to ask questions, but we do it to inject some real issue that isn't being addressed rather than to just disrupt for disruption's sake. And then that leads me to your first question, which is about are these groups real grassroots organizations or AstroTurf? I think it's hard to make a judgment about that. Certainly there are some of them that are being funded by conservative interests that are related to the very companies that would stand to lose from a real healthcare reform. but we have to recognize that a lot of them are just grassroots folks who are concerned about their access to the health care they have now, or concerned about how this will affect their taxes and all kinds of legitimate issues. The problem is they have been very much misled by a conservative press that just wants to see Obama fail. And there I think we see something very interesting, which is the reason that these groups have been so successful is not only because there's some money involved in trying to help organize, but it's because the conservative press actually takes a stand and encourages people to go out to these meetings, just like they encourage people to go out to the tea parties. So you can turn on Fox News and you can hear the host saying, you know, this will be happening here and here's a website to look at. Now, I love Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow, but they don't really encourage people to go out and protest. We've never been allowed a space on their shows to go and say, hey, we have this demonstration coming up, rally the troops. They try to take a step back from the activists. And I think that in this time, when there really is a need to get people out on the streets, be it for health care or around Afghanistan or issues around getting a real accountability, that the progressive media should not only support that, but should actively help get people out to these kinds of things.
Medea, just one last question, if I could, and that has to do with the window of opportunity here with what, you know, is an historic majority of Democrats, many of them progressives in the House and Senate. And it seems that in the style of FDR, although Obama may have said, you know, get out there in the streets and make me do it, you know, in terms of following through on a progressive agenda, that really hasn't worked all that well, and it's Obama's not making that request of activist groups as much as maybe he could. Do you see a window of opportunity for the progressive agenda slipping away here if groups don't take concerted action in the next 6 months to a year?
Oh, definitely. On so many issues, the issue around the energy bill and real effective action on global warming, issues around healthcare, certainly. We've already talked about the issue of the wars. There are so many issues that are slipping away from us and that we haven't seen the change that we hope to see, and that too many groups are willing to hold off. We were at this retreat we're at. There was one woman that said, well, I'm going to give Obama a year's grace period. And we said, do you know how much damage can be done? And look at all the opportunities that were wasted in the first 6 months. You can't sit back and give anybody a grace period. You got to be actively out there, as you said, pushing Obama to do the right thing, or he never will. And we have lost that momentum. And if we want to see these progressive changes, that some of them were promised to us by Obama and some of them weren't. I mean, he never said he was going to pull the troops out of Afghanistan. But we do have to be the force behind that. And especially in these difficult economic times, when people are struggling and looking for answers, they can easily be brought over to the side of a right-wing agenda. A false populism, and we don't want that happening. We have to capture people who are concerned about the financial bailout of Wall Street, people who are concerned about the lack of movement around stopping the foreclosure crisis, the 50 million people in this country who don't have access to health care, the growing number of homeless people. They've got to be brought into this debate in an active way and from a progressive point of view.
Well, Medea, thanks so much for all your work and for joining us tonight. Do leave the listeners with a way they can get in touch with you and your group there at Code Pink.
Yes, I have two hats that I'd like to mention. One is Code Pink, and the website is codepinkalert.org. We have not only some interesting things coming up around Afghanistan and Iraq, but we've been doing a lot of work on Israel, Palestine, Gaza, and for January 1st, we're organizing a massive march inside Gaza to call for an end to the siege. So check us out on the Code Pink website or the GazaFreedomMarch.org. And lastly, I'd like to use my hat as Global Exchange. We promote fair trade, citizen involvement in economic as well as political issues, and you can check us out at globalexchange.org and travel with us to many of the places around the world that are involved in exciting grassroots change that can inspire us here at home.
Yeah, I saw recently the website some exciting trips to Venezuela and Cuba, Vietnam, and elsewhere all around the world. The reality tours that you've been doing for many years at Global Exchange are excellent, an opportunity for people to see a part of the world they might not otherwise see in a group tour setting. But again, thanks for being here with us tonight, Medea. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the groups Global Exchange and Code Pink Women for Peace. We're going to take a musical break and be back in just a little bit. More discussion on the healthcare reform debate here in the U.S. Stay with us. This is WPKN in Bridgeport and WPKM in Montauk, New York. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint. And coming up, we have a discussion on the struggle for an increase in the minimum wage in Haiti. That's coming up a little later. And we'll also be speaking with Anurima Bagarva, an assistant counsel with the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, talking about a recent federal court decision upholding the University of Texas at Austin's consideration of race in student admission. So that's all coming up. But right now, I'm very happy to introduce to you Maryland psychiatrist Dr. Carol Paris. She's an active member with the group Physicians for a National Health Program, made up of some 17,000 doctors, medical students, and health workers who advocate a single-payer health care system. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Paris.
My pleasure.
Dr. Paris, you were arrested, one of eight persons arrested at a May 5th, earlier this year, Senate Finance Committee hearing chaired by Montana Senator Max Baucus, demanding a fair hearing for the single-payer health care the single-payer healthcare system. And I wonder, as we begin here, it might be good, although we've had representatives of PNHP, the Physicians for National Health Program, on this program before. Tell our listeners a little bit about this organization.
Well, PNHP has been in existence for 22 years with a mission of educating about the single payer option for financing health care. So they've been about this for 22 years and doing education and also some of the really fine research, one most recently by Steffi Woolhandler and David Himmelstein, where they looked at bankruptcy data from 2006 and discovered that, you know, 62% of all personal bankruptcies in the United States are due to medical debt, and that three-quarters of the people who were bankrupted actually had insurance at the time that they became ill. So this is the kind of work that PNHP has been about. It's only been since May 5th that they broke into the sort of more advocacy and civil disobedience realm with the arrest of three PNHP physicians and a total of eight advocates. And I certainly hope that the viewers, if they aren't aware of that action already, I want them to understand that this was not an impulsive decision. We had been working, we had been writing to Senator Baucus and the Senate Finance Committee requesting a seat at the table. We offered several names of people who are experts that could present on the single-payer information, and they just kept turning us down and saying, we're not interested in hearing about single-payer. It's off the table. We're not giving you a seat at the table. And so that was the point at which we decided that we needed to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience. And so we did that on May 5th.
What is the current status of health care reform in your view? And, of course, this comes after a month of very noisy demonstrations and trying to drown out discussion at many of these congressional and Senate-sponsored town hall meetings to discuss health care reform. It seems that many conservative Democrats and even the White House was taken aback by opposition demonstrations and have seemingly, been intimidated to move back quite a bit in terms of pushing for a public option, if nothing else.
Well, I think it's important to realize that many of these noisy people at town hall meetings are being fronted by organizations, the money of which comes from the stakeholders like the private insurance industry. And they're playing on people's fear and, most importantly, their lack of knowledge, education, information. I spoke to a woman today in my office who came in and said, "Oh, Dr. Paris, I'm so proud of you for getting arrested." And then when she realized that I got arrested in support of single payer and not because I'm a Blue Dog Democrat, she was just dumbfounded. So we talked for maybe 15 minutes, and when she left my office, she had been completely transformed from a fearful person who had no clear understanding of what the issues are to someone who was scratching her head and saying, "What was that website again? PNHP.org? That makes a lot of sense." So I think what we're seeing in the town hall meetings is a very clear manifestation of the continued work that needs to be done to educate people about what the real issues are. Most importantly, about to ask them to really ponder, what value are you getting from your insurance company? What value do you get from the money that you spend on your premiums? These are the questions that we haven't been, well, these are the questions PNHP has been asking, but unfortunately, the proponents of single payer are still being marginalized in the mainstream media. So this kind of education takes place sometimes just one-on-one in doctors' offices, at kitchen tables, at small town hall forums. Dr. Flowers and I attended one in Norfolk yesterday. So the movement is growing, but it is so important for people to be educated and to listen, not only to Fox News, but to other sources of news as well.
We're speaking with Maryland psychiatrist Dr. Carol Paris, a member of the group Physicians for a National Health Program. Where do you see negotiations heading as we get here to September, where a lot of the work on this reform legislation is going to get done after all the noise in August? Do you see the Democrats standing up and pushing through at least something like what's been proposed in different pieces of legislation, a public option, or do you think they'll be shrinking back from that?
I'm certainly not a pundit, but my take on it is that the amount of money that's being spent by the so-called stakeholders, $1.4 million a day, that's the amount of money that they're putting in to Washington, D.C., to make sure that really no substantive reform takes place, and especially not a public option. I think they're going to be successful at blocking that. And I think that either we're going to see nothing happen, nothing will pass. Possibly we will, unfortunately, pass a very watered-down bill that has triggers or co-ops instead of a robust Medicaid-based public option. And I haven't given up on the hope that when the Wiener Amendment comes to a floor vote, we'll have single payer.
So you still have hope?
I do indeed. I'm a psychiatrist, so you have to give me a little leeway here. I spend my whole life, professional life, working with people, and I know that people can change their minds, that they can look quietly inside themselves and have a moment of enlightenment and realize and change their thinking drastically. I believe that we can accomplish that. I saw it happen in my office with one patient today, and I think that if we can accomplish that with the president and 535 members of Congress, we might just pass single payer.
Dr. Paris, it seems that a lot of the negotiations, the important negotiations ongoing right now in the Senate, which is critical to the passage of any future health care reform bill, is going on with three Democrats and three Republicans in the Senate Finance Committee, with Max Baucus there as chair. Is this the way to go about, you think? Should this be the method by which a final bill is hammered out, or do you think there's something else should be happening?
Well, I hope that all of your listeners would agree with me that something else should be happening. Even Max Baucus's own constituents are furious with him. The heads of the Democratic, the county Democratic committees in Montana have written to him and expressed their frustration and anger at him for keeping his own constituents out of the debate, much less the rest of the people in the United States. So no, this is not the way it should be happening. It is the way things seem to get done in Washington. But I think that there is still hope that that's not going to be what we end up with, that the American people will fight back and say, we either want true, comprehensive reform or nothing at all. Because really and truly, what they're coming up with in the way of a public option, or an option for the public option, is premised, all of these reforms are premised on maintaining the private insurance industry. And that is the fatal flaw. That is where the problem resides, in all of the administrative waste and profit that goes into the private insurance industry and not into delivering health care to the people who are paying the premiums. There's no value for our premium dollars.
Dr. Paris, there's been a lot of criticisms of government health care, despite the fact that Medicare has been so successful and many senior citizens would never trade it away. But the idea of a public option here in this current debate over health care reform, it seems to be, there's a lot of hesitance to go in for another big government program. And as an antidote to that, many conservative Democrats and others are pushing the idea of co-ops, cooperatives, regional cooperatives. What in your mind, is the value of what's the relative comparison between a federal public government insurance option versus co-ops?
Well, if we look at history, they tried co-ops back in the 30s during the Depression, and in spite of a great deal of government subsidies initially, they failed. Most co-ops never reach a sufficient size to become financially viable or to deal with just market fluctuations. The health analysts, the experts, suggest that you need at least 500,000 people enrolled in a plan in order for it to be financially viable. And one of those plans, the Group Health Cooperative in Washington State, currently has 600,000 members and is a pretty effective plan, but it took them 62 years to reach that enrollment. I don't think we have 62 years to wait for co-ops to become viable and for our government to be subsidizing them until they do become standalone viable entities.
How do you respond to the idea that, with our current economic crisis, the country just can't afford the public option now? It's just too expensive, estimate of $9 trillion over the next 10 years. You think the trade-off's worth it in terms of the deficits the country might be racking up to get a system that will truly be universal?
Well, wait a minute. You're mixing universality with the public option, and the public option is not going to be universal.
That's an important point. Yes, please emphasize that, because it's not.
The public option isn't even going to come close to reaching universality. It will leave upwards of 32 million people out, and those will be the 32 million people who don't qualify for Medicare or Medicaid and don't make enough money or qualify for the subsidies. And so 32 million people will not be insured with this new system. And as I said before, the public option is just another plan added onto our existing private insurance industry. And so I would agree that it is a system that is too expensive and doomed to failure. In fact, I call it a bailout for the private insurance industry. We're basically going to just be giving the private insurance industry $1 trillion over 10 years so that they can continue to give the American people no value for their investment, unless, I guess, if you're invested in Aetna or Cigna or one of those. If you have stock options in those companies, at least your stocks will be going up well. But I don't think that's what most people are hoping for. The only way to accomplish true universality, and to do that in a fiscally neutral way is to enact expanded and improved Medicare for All, H.R. 676. And we actually do have a chance of that with the fall, the return of Congress this fall. The Wiener Amendment, it's called the Wiener Amendment, Congressman Anthony Wiener from New York, who's a member of the Energy and Commerce Committee, introduced an amendment that would essentially replace the language of H.R. 3200 with the language of H.R. 676, turning the bill into a single-payer bill. He took that action just before the August recess, and the chairman, Mr. Waxman, and Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, in an effort to try and get the bill out of committee, agreed that if he would remove his amendment, that they would bring that amendment, the Wiener Amendment, to a debate and a full vote before the House of Representatives in the fall. So it is going to have an up or down vote.
Dr. Carol Paris, a Maryland psychiatrist, is our guest tonight here on Counterpoint. And Dr. Paris, I wanted to ask you about the Canadian system, because there's a lot of myths and realities that get tossed around about the Canadian system. And I ran across a poll not that long ago, and it says that the Toronto-based Nanos Research during mid-August did a poll and found that there was overwhelming support, 86.2%, for strengthening Canada's public health care system rather than expanding for-profit services. And from a lot of the talk you hear of critics of health care reform in the United States, Canadians are very unhappy with their system, that there's a lot of rationing and people are waiting in line for, you know, urgent treatment. You even see some advertisements discuss the idea that people are losing their lives because of the healthcare system in Canada and the universal healthcare systems in Britain and elsewhere in Europe. As a doctor yourself, how do you view what Canadians have by way of their single payer system?
Well, I can tell you just from a little anecdote. The day that I was arrested, when I got out of jail, I met my sisters for dinner back in Silver Spring, Maryland. And my younger sister said, "Gee, you know, I'm going to Canada next week. I'm going to do my own little poll and just see what Canadians think of their health care." And what she came back and told me was that she had great fun talking to people about her sister, a doctor who got arrested for standing up in support of single-payer health care reform, and that to a person, the Canadians just rolled their eyes, shook their heads, and said, "You know, you silly Americans, when are you going to get with the program and realize that that there's no value in your private insurance industry, and that your people are dying and going bankrupt for lack of access to health care? That is something that does not happen in Canada." I think that when your listeners see those infomercials on TV, it's important for you to pay attention, or when you see them in the written press, to look at the source. Usually it's at the bottom of the page, or you know, in small print on your TV screen, who's actually sponsoring that so-called information. There are a number of front organizations who, Rick Scott, for example, put up $20 million of his own money. I forget the name. I think it may be Americans for Prosperity. That may be him. I'm not sure. But I do know that Mr. Scott put up $20 million of his own money to and hired the same PR firm that did the Swift boat ads that brought down John Kerry's presidential bid. So, and Mr. Scott is the former CEO of Columbia HCA, Hospital Corporation of America. He was found guilty in 1998 for egregious Medicare and Medicaid fraud. So, you know, I think people have to consider the source of their information.
And Dr. Paris, we're just about out of time here, but as you look at the opportunities here for healthcare reform, genuine healthcare reform, and you know what likely could be a watered down result in terms of the final legislation that could be signed into law, do you feel that no healthcare reform at all this year might be a better result than having a watered down plan that really doesn't change the current system all that much, or would it be wiser for healthcare reform advocates to take advantage of whatever momentum we have here to get something passed at whatever cost?
I have to say that I think having nothing happen would be better than having a watered down bill, because I know the way the spin works in Washington. They will spin a watered down bill and make us think that it's comprehensive reform, and it may look that way for the first few years, but people have to understand that if this bill gets enacted, it won't even go into effect until 2013. Now, why do you think they don't want it going it to be actually operationalized until 2013? Well, that would be the year after the presidential re-election. There's so much more that goes into this than meets the eye. Now, there is, if they do pass a watered-down bill, there is one amendment that I hope remains in the final bill, and that would be Dennis Kucinich's amendment, which has made it so far through the Senate Help Committee. What Dennis Kucinich's bill would do is remove the barriers to individual states that want to enact single payer on a statewide basis, so that it creates waivers for the Medicare and Medicaid monies and some barriers through ERISA, which gets into a whole level of policy that I wouldn't begin to be able to explain. I just know that the ERISA legislation has been used as a way to prevent states from enacting single payer and coming up with a way of financing it.
Yeah, as you may know, Connecticut has actually voted in something called SustaNet. They haven't funded it yet, but it could be a way to get not universal care possibly at the start, but certainly working the way towards getting more people health insurance coverage. And I believe Canada's single-payer healthcare system began with one province actually leading the way. They had a successful single-payer system, and the rest of the nation followed there in Canada.
That is true. Tommy Douglas did it in Saskatchewan, and just as you said, it was so successful that then the other provinces signed on. I think that that's a very hopeful message for us that even if we pass a watered-down bill, so long as individual states can enact single-payer, and that actual amendment got Republican support as well as Democratic support, because the Republicans support states' rights. It was a states' rights issue for many of the Republicans who voted for that amendment. So I think that that has some real hope, and I would be fine with that if we start with one or two states enacting single-payer legislation and demonstrating that it is advantageous to all of the citizens, not just the uninsured, but the insured as well. people have to understand that a single-payer system would be financially advantageous for 95% of people in the United States. So it's not just a nice idea for taking care of those who are less fortunate than us. It's actually a way of reducing the overall health care expenditures for 95% of the people in America.
Well, Dr. Paris, we're out of time, but I want to thank you so much for being here and your optimism about the future of single payer in this country. We need a little optimism right about now and some activism, too, as you said. But tell our listeners how they can get in touch with your group, Physicians for a National Health Program.
We can be reached at www.pnhp.org. That's Physicians for a National Health Program. I also recommend healthcare-now.org as another website with lots of good information.
All right. Well, again, thanks so much for all your work and for being here with us tonight. Dr. Carol Paris, a Maryland psychiatrist and member of Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP.org.
Thank you. Wish me good luck tomorrow night at our town hall meeting in Waldorf.
That's right. Get your shouting voice in order there, practiced. Well, hopefully you can speak quietly and carry a big stick.
I speak very quietly, and then people have to be quiet to hear what I have to say, and it works sometimes.
Good enough. I like that strategy.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night, Doctor.
Good night.
Bye-bye. And that discussion of healthcare reform, we're going to be back with a peek at what's going on in terms of activism in the nation of Haiti with Kim Ives in just a few minutes. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM.
Hi, my name is Bob Johnson, and I'm the program director at WPKN. If you're a longtime listener to the station, in the next few weeks you're going to be noticing some important changes both in our schedule and our format. You probably know that historically most of our air shifts have been 4 hours long, and starting this month that's going to change. From now on, most of our programs will be 3 hours in length. You might also find that some of your favorite WPKN programs have changed either the day or time when they are broadcast, or both. We've made these changes in an effort to make our programming sound fresher, allow more new programmers on the air, and to create a more cohesive sound. WPKN will remain the creative and free voice of non-commercial radio in southern New England. We will continue to work hard to provide you with a worthwhile and fun listening experience while better serving our community. In the days ahead, we will be refining our new schedule and also updating our online listening guide. If you have any questions about these changes or simply need to know where your favorite shows are on our new schedule, you can always feel free to call, write, or email. None of us at WPKN and WPKM forget for 1 minute that you are the reason we're here, and without you, we would not exist. Thanks.
So a lot of changes here, including This Way Out, which precedes Counterpoint here for many, many years, is now moved to another slot. There is supposedly going to be a program guide up on the WPKN.org website, but that has not happened yet. Or hopefully, maybe it's there and I'm just behind the times. Between the Lines Radio News Magazine just now moved from 8 a.m. on Wednesday morning and Tuesday afternoons and Saturday afternoons. It's going to be broadcast once Wednesday at 12 noon between the lines and once on Sunday at 5 p.m. Anyway, that's some of the new changes, but hopefully, and I apologize for not getting a lot of advance word to our listeners about these changes. Really, there was a lot of staff input that there should have been more advance notice, but for whatever reason, there wasn't, and right now we're in the middle of these changes occurring as we speak. And hopefully, like I said, the WPKN.org website will be the place to go to look at the new schedule to find out where some of your favorite shows have ended up. But to that end, we do want to hear your reaction after you listen to the schedule, get acquainted with it. Do send your feedback to a new email address that is WPKN Board Secretary I set up to get your feedback. It's called, or I actually should say the address is WPKNfeedback at yahoo.com, WPKNfeedback at yahoo.com. So like it, dislike it, or don't care. Either way, we'd like to hear from you because you are, as Bob Johnson said in the previous announcement, you're the reason we are on the air. And without you, we're nothing. So that email address one more time is WPKNfeedback at yahoo.com. And your letters, whatever they say, will be passed on to board members, the general manager, and the program director. With that said, I want to thank you for listening tonight and introduce a good friend of the program, Kim Ives, editor with the Haiti Liberté newspaper. Kim is a documentary filmmaker and activist with the Haiti Support Network. He also is a producer at WBAI Radio in New York City, where he does a program about Haiti. Kim, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
First of all, tell our listeners a bit about your newspaper, Haiti Liberté, and how they can find it on the web.
It can be found at HaitiLiberté.com. That's just liberty with an E on the end. And we were founded about 2 years ago on the anniversary of the first U.S. military occupation of Haiti. And really, that's part of the paper's mission. It is an anti-imperialist paper. Its the motto is justice, truth, and independence. And it takes a lot of the writers and people who were involved at the Haiti Progre and Fanfan Latour and Anthony Montparousse, Mauricio Lazar. There were quite a few who were writing at Progre are now at Haiti Liberté, and we have a very warm reception in the community.
Kim, having a little trouble hearing. If you could speak up in the mic there on the phone,
okay.
Help a little bit. But
okay.
if you can bring us up to speed, if you would, on a recent protest movement calling for an increase in Haiti's daily minimum wage. And I guess we should start with the facts of the hemisphere's poorest nation and what the average Haitian worker makes per day. Certainly some of the lowest in the hemisphere, if not the world.
Correct. It's been for the past several years since it was raised, in fact, under the first Aristide administration, it's 70 gourds a day. That translates to something under $2. Goal was to raise that minimum wage. Basically, it's about 40 gourds, 39, 38 gourds to the dollar. Call has gone out for about the past year to raise it to 200 gourds. This was introduced in the parliament by a parliamentarian named Stephen Benoit, and it passed the parliament and was, in fact, on its way to become law. 200 gourds a day would be about $5, which would still be the lowest minimum wage in the hemisphere. Next door in the Dominican Republic, they are $9 a day minimum wage in the free trade zones. President Preval, René Preval, who was elected in 2006, in February 2006, putting an end to the coup d'etat of 2004, put the kibosh on that and said no, that the minimum wage should be set at 125 gourds. It went back to the parliament. They tried to pass it at 150 gourds. That was rejected because it violated all kinds of parliamentary procedure. And they asked for a revote, and the parliamentarians put it at 125. This caused extreme outrage, as one can imagine, among the factory workers and, above all, the students. Students have been demanding this and protesting for this for some time. Past 6-7 months, and those have been some fairly violent demonstrations. I should say violent, not on the students' part, but on the repressive force brought against them. So when that vote went through 2 weeks ago, that caused all hell to break loose, and that's where we stand right now.
What's the scene on the ground in some of the cities in Haiti where these protests have occurred? I've read that the National Haitian Police and the United Nations occupation forces have dealt quite brutally with those protesters and the students.
That's precisely it. It's been very severe repression against particularly the students, who have been a lot more vociferous in their support for the 200 gourd minimum wage. And the troops have shot students, and the police have shot students. There's been tear gas almost on a daily basis at a lot of the schools. Essentially, for the past 4 or 5 months, the university was all but shut down. And right now there was something of a lull, and then this past week a high school kid was shot to death by a policeman. There was a rumor that went out that the cutoff for the baccalaureate exams was lowered to 50%, and a lot of students poured out to the various schools, and when they got there, they were told by the examiners that, oh, no, it's not that at all. It's up at the usual figure, which is 70 or 80%. And they became irate, and a lot of the schools had very violent demonstrations with school material being torn up and burned and so forth. And it was in the midst of this that a student was shot to death, and that, of course, just poured gasoline on the fire. So it's an extremely tense situation, Scott, particularly in Port-au-Prince, but also in some of the provincial cities like Gonaïves and Jacmel and Okai.
The students, from what I've read, have also been protesting not just for the increase in the minimum wage, but for an improvement of conditions at the state university, which I imagine is underfunded and the infrastructure is probably falling apart. But tell us what the situation is at the university. What are the big issues there?
Well, that's really how it started, was at the Faculty of Medicine, the School of Medicine. The students began asking essentially for better conditions of study, because practically there's we're not just talking about medical supplies, which are not there, but we're talking about things as fundamental as chalk and chairs and books and paper and pencils. So they asked for improvement on all those fronts. So it really was a call for more funding for the university. Then really what happened is that spread to some of the other schools, and the School of Social Sciences in Nagoya inserted the call of 200 gourd minimum wage. There are a number of groups who have links to unions, and they sort of help shepherd in that demand, and that went back to the students at the medicine school and at another school called the Normale Supérieure. So all the schools started to pick up on this, and I should say the other principal demand to calling for improvement in the school conditions is the call for an end to the foreign military occupation of Haiti, the UN occupation, which is now in its fifth year. And the students are outraged and upset by this because of the daily humiliation and abuse and brutalization that they experience at the hands of UN soldiers. So those three calls have really formed, I could say, the three roches de feu, as they call them in Creole, the three foundation rocks of the student movement.
We're speaking with Kim Ives, editor with the newspaper Haiti Liberté, a documentary filmmaker and activist with the Haiti Support Network. Kim Ives also hosts a radio program at WBAI in New York City. And Kim, why don't you give a little bit of the information of that show, when it can be heard, and that information.
That's Haiti, The Struggle Continues. We're a weekly show every Thursday night from 9 to 10 on WBAI, which is 99.5 FM, if you're in the New York metropolitan area. Otherwise, you can get it on the web at WBAI.org. We stream live, and the programs are archived for 3 months on the site. This program is really a collaboration between various progressive groups here in New York. The International Support Haiti Network, of which I'm a part, and Haiti Liberté work with a local group here called CACOLA, or the Comité to Support the Struggle of the People in Haiti. And with the collaboration of those two groups, we put that weekly show together.
And that's WBAI, our sister station, as a Pacific affiliate. WPKN is tied in with that network as well, and that's WBAI 99.5 FM. And Kim, what are the pressures on Haitian President René Préval in his rejection of this rise in the minimum wage? What are the companies and the industrialists doing to pressure him to really reduce the Parliament-approved rate of the minimum wage increase?
Essentially, the coup d'etat of 2004 was carried out by the what is often called the assembly industry bourgeoisie. Haiti traditionally had two ruling classes. One was the big landowners, not because they own big tracts of land as you see in Latin America, but they hold lots of little plots. Those were called the grandons, and they were more or less the rural-based ruling class. François Duvalier was an archetypal representative of this group. And the other class was the comprador bourgeoisie, which was really an import-export bourgeoisie. The past few decades, import-export bourgeoisie role has diminished as the whole nature of shipping and commerce have changed, and really they've morphed into more bourgeoisie, which runs the factories, which take advantage of Haiti's cheap labor. And so the import-export bourgeoisie, of course, was extremely vexed with Aristide when he would come and talk about raising the minimum wage and giving workers all kinds of rights, and were part of the National Endowment for Democracy financed opposition, civil opposition, which was called the Group of 184, and it was headed by a guy called Andy Apted and Charles Baker, who are two of the biggest assembly industry owners. So these are the people today putting the squeeze on Préval, and they went to Préval, another guy called Reginald Bulos, and the Bulos family is a very big bourgeois family who also runs out of Washington the primary think tank, which provided a lot of the disinformation that fueled the coup called the Haiti Democracy Project. Other families like the Bronze, there's about 11 or 12 families which really control this sector. So they basically met with Préval and they said, listen, if that minimum wage goes to 200 gourdes, you know, we're going to close our factories and move to Miami or whatever. All kinds of threats were made. And Préval, rather than standing up to them or calling their bluff, because it was pure bluff, said, okay, and, you know, vetoed the vote of both houses of the parliament. And now we're back to 125 gourdes.
Kim, what's next here? The students are continuing their protests, from what I gather, but what's next in terms of the confrontation between the parliament and President René Préval over the minimum wage hike?
Well, at this point, the House of Deputies has essentially passed it, and that was the key one. The senators will next vote on it. So if they do pass the 125 rate, then it will become law, and that's where it will be. You know, I think that essentially Haiti is a tinderbox, as it has generally been over the past two decades or so, since Duvalier left in 1986. And it is more so now than ever because the poverty and hunger and the difficulty of living in Haiti has just become so extreme. It's been maybe mitigated somewhat by the fact that the International Monetary Fund and World Bank basically forgave $1.2 billion of debt that Haiti had. This was something that was costing the country about $5 million a month to pay interest on. And in fact, they did pay a lot of interest and paid for it also in terms of jumping through all sorts of hoops that those international financial institutions put out for them. But this has given the Préval government a little margin and to some extent should be given to the workers whose life is hell. Even when you have a job, to just get to it and eat is practically impossible on the wage that they're proposing of 125 gourdes. Even 200 gourdes isn't really enough, but it's 125 is just way short. And so I think the demonstrations will continue. I think the unrest will continue, and the one of the principal flashpoints will be the minimum wage question, as well as the continuation of the UN military occupation.
Remind us again, 125 gourd is equivalent to how many U.S. dollars?
125 is about $3. Again, it's about 39 gourds to the dollar, generally. I mean, the rate fluctuates a little bit. So let's say 40. So if you take 125, you talk about $3.05 about, as opposed to about $5 at 200 gourds.
But raising, the, you know, just it seems to me, as you said before, that these industrialists, the maquiladoras or whatever they are, threatening to leave the island of Haiti. Where are they going to go where it's cheaper? I guess, is China cheaper? I'm not sure of the economics here of export, import, and the cost of labor. But what are some of those, you know, facts out there in the real world here that would dictate that Haiti has to suppress their wages in order to keep the few jobs that are on the island?
That's just it, Scott. You put your finger on the essence there. It isn't any cheaper. In the Dominican Republic right next door, which has, you know, it's totally checkered with free trade zones, these meaning zones where business comes in, assembles their products and ships it out all tax-free, you're talking about a minimum wage of $9, which is about the mean throughout most of Central America, Honduras, El Salvador, Costa Rica. These are the other countries which provide a lot of these bases. And, you know, the fact is, and this is our thinking here at Haiti Liberté, that a lot of the emphasis that you see the Clintons and Obama putting on Haiti, we think comes from the fact that they're trying to set up a sort of, you know, or rebuild, I could say, the cheap labor infrastructure in this hemisphere, in the U.S. pond of the Caribbean, because sending it to China essentially is starting to become problematic for two reasons. One, we are, you know, starting to get into real geopolitical conflict with China as the crisis continues here, and their debt, which they hold in treasury notes, becomes an issue, one. And two, just transport. With the end of oil and the cost of oil going up, and it will again spike soon, it's becoming a lot less attractive to ship your items from halfway around the world, and a lot easier to do it 600 miles away from Miami in Haiti. So I think for these two reasons, you know, this threat that the assembly industry bourgeoisie gave to Preval was completely bluff, because they don't have anywhere else to go, and Haiti is the bottom at this point, and it shouldn't be as low as they're trying to make it.
Well, Kim, we're just about out of time, but we got a minute or two left. Give us your quick take on former President Bill Clinton's appointment as the United Nations Special Envoy to Haiti. What does that mean? He did preside over the first overthrow of the Aristide government and then restored him to power. So he's got certainly an ironic role in Haiti's history here to be named Special Envoy. But what do you make of Bill Clinton and what he will do as Special Envoy?
Yeah. Well, first I should say, Scott, that in fact it was George Bush I who was presiding over that first coup in on September 30th, 1991. And Clinton came in basically on the assumption by most Haitians who voted for him that he was going to bring Aristide back and stop sending refugees back. Well, he reneged on that immediately, even before he was inaugurated, and said, well, I am in fact going to send refugees back. And he didn't in fact return Aristide, and it was only because there was a tremendous new wave of refugees that came out and tremendous new demonstrations in New York and Miami and around the world that finally he was forced in September 1994 to bring Aristide back. But he brought Aristide back as a prisoner in a cage with all sorts of conditions that he basically implement in front for a neoliberal restructuring of Haiti. And Aristide essentially backtracked on that. He did a thing called marronage in Haiti, which is where you say you're going to do something, but you don't really do it. And he didn't, and it ended up creating very bad blood between Aristide and the Clinton government, and essentially they pushed him out of power when the people were asking him to stay in for the 3 years that he spent in exile in 1996. And really, we have to remember also that Bill Clinton was the... It was under his government that the embargo on Haiti in 2000 began after the elections of 2000 that elected Aristide for the second time. So, nonetheless, what has stuck in the popular imagination, both in Haiti and the U.S., is that Clinton was the guy who brought Aristide back to Haiti, and therefore he's Aristide's friend. And the call for Aristide to return, Aristide still remains the symbol of the Haitian people's resistance and aspirations. And so in many ways, they're counting on that identification to carry him through. But to me, he's primarily there, Scott, to find a way to keep the U.N. occupation in place. It's supposed to expire in October 15th, 2009, but I think they want to keep it there, keep those troops there, and keep Haiti under wraps because it remains this rebellious country that was the first free nation of Latin America.
Well, thanks for that correction on a bit of history I got mixed up with. Blame Clinton for everything,
it's,
huh?
It's a little confusing.
No, but I appreciate that clarification for our listeners, too. Kim, leave our folks listening tonight with the web address again for your newspaper, Haiti Liberté.
It's Haiti Liberté. That's liberty with an E on the end instead of a Y, .com, HaitiLiberté.com, where, in fact, redoing our website shortly, we'll have a new and improved one up. Will be much more user-friendly, but we do encourage people to go there, and they can look at all our back issues. The archives are there. And and for the radio show, again, it's at WBAI.org, Haiti, the Struggle Continues, Thursday from 9 to 10.
Kim, thanks so much for being here with us tonight, and appreciate all your work on issues relating to Haiti and sharing those analysis with us tonight. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Take care. Good night.
Okay, bye.
We'll be back in just a few minutes with a discussion of an important federal court case as it affects the issue of race and student admissions at the University of Texas and around the country. Stay with us.
Him go put Martin Week until he brother away, not be so. Them go proud of them name and put them slave name for heading, not be so. Them go proud of them name and put them slave name for heading, not be so. Colour mentality now make you hear me now.
Music from the Nigerian song sensation Fela. From many years ago. This is a song called Colonial Mentality. Here on Counterpoint in WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk, New York, the late, great Fela. Right now I'd like to welcome to the program Anurima Bhargava. She's an assistant counsel at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. In a recent federal court decision upheld the University of Texas at Austin's consideration of race in student admissions there. The case, Fisher versus Texas, is the first federal court challenge to the use of race in university admissions since the 2003 Grutter versus Bollinger U.S. Supreme Court decision allowing universities to take race into account in recruiting a diverse student body. And right now, thank you, Anurima, for joining us to talk about this.
Thank you for having me.
Tell our listeners first the NAACP Legal Fund's involvement. What was the role your group had in this case?
In this case, we represented a group of African-American students who are either interested in going to the University of Texas or actually currently enrolled there. And we wanted to represent their viewpoint and their experience at the University of Texas. The African-American population is rather small. It's around 4%, and it's hovered from 4 to 7 in the last couple of years. But for African-American students there, for the vast majority of them, 90% of classrooms really have either no or one African-American student, and it's been a very isolating experience. So we came in to support the University of Texas and its efforts to try to bring in a more diverse student body. And we did that by sort of bringing in the perspective of African-American students to the case.
And Anurima, who were the plaintiffs? How did this case come about? What were the central issues being brought before the federal court?
Sure. So University of Texas, unlike a lot of different states, we don't have that, and we don't have similar policies in Connecticut or New York or any part of the Northeast, but Texas has what's known as a 10% plan, and that means that if you are in the top 10% of your high school class, you are guaranteed admission into the University of Texas. And you know, as to which campus you go to, there's a number of different things that are involved, but you are guaranteed that admission. And so the vast majority of students who are going into the University of Texas at Austin, about 80%, are coming in through the 10% plan, but the university still has, you know, a fifth of their student body coming in through what we know is like a typical admissions process. You look at someone's grades and their extracurricular activities and, you know, their neighborhood and lots of other things, and they may be admitted on that basis. And so the people who brought this case are two white students who didn't get in through the 10% plan but also didn't get in through the admissions process. And what they're claiming is that the university gets enough diversity through the 10% plan and should be banned from using race or considering race or looking at anything about someone's racial experience in the admissions process. And they don't say that the University of Texas is doing anything that the Supreme Court said in the 2003 case that they couldn't do. They're just saying you've got enough diversity as it is. You shouldn't do, you know, you don't need to do anything here. So that's how the case came about. They brought the case because they didn't get in and they weren't unhappy about it and sued.
The results of the case is that the federal judge ruled in your favor, saying that this is certainly in compliance with the Supreme Court decision. How do you assess the decision? How important is it for the future of racial diversity at the University of Texas, but more importantly, all around the country?
Well, what we're seeing around the country and at the University of Texas is that the universities need every tool they have. I mean, to try and bring in a more diverse student body, to try to make sure that universities that have been, you know, really closed off to students who are low income, who are first generation or of diverse racial backgrounds, that they actually open up to all those kinds of students. And so universities are looking for tools to be able to do that, and they need a full tool set, you know. And what this case is about is that University of Texas has gotten through a long history of They were sued back in the 1990s about their admissions policy as well. I mean, they've gone through a long history of trying to figure out what they can do to bring in students of different racial backgrounds because of a very racially charged and discriminatory past, and one that University of Texas will acknowledge is part of the reason why they take such effort today. And so for them and for universities around the country, this case is again the first federal court challenge we've seen, and the fact that you see a court saying, you know, we understand that University of Texas has been struggling with this, and they're trying to do the best they can, and more importantly, that we live in an increasingly diverse society, and what's at stake here is ever more important. I mean, I think that's where we really see what the national significance is of this case. It's a federal district court decision, so that means it can still go up on appeal to a federal appellate court, and then eventually could be taken by the U.S. Supreme Court, but that's a long way away at this point.
Do you see the appeal going forward and being accepted if it does end up at the Supreme Court? Do you think they would revisit this issue?
It's hard to say for sure, but I think my sense is that one of the reasons why they might not want to take this case up and revisit this issue is because it is, a case that involves a very specific type of plan, which is the 10% plan. It's not something that it's very fact specific, and so that's not usually what the Supreme Court of the United States wants to take up. But you never know.
Well, the complexion of the court in terms of politics, right and left, has changed a lot since 2003. Do you think the more conservative justices that are on the court now will be anxious to revisit this and maybe overturn it?
I think that they would, if they were given a shot to do so, would want that opportunity. I don't know how it would end up coming out in the end. We saw a case about diversity at the K-12 levels in elementary and high schools that went up in 2007, and it was one of the most deeply divided decisions in among a very deeply divided court that we've seen in years, with a vehement the longest dissent that Justice Stephen Breyer on the Supreme Court has ever written. In that case, it was split, and it ended up being a limited ruling, but which said that diversity is important even in the K-12 arena, and that school districts should have the ability to try and promote that diversity, just again limiting the tools that they had to do that. So, they've taken these types of cases in recent years. There's no question that they are open to doing so. It's just, whether or not it'll be this one or another one that may come up, it's hard to say.
Anna Rima Bargava is our guest tonight. She's an assistant counsel at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, and we're analyzing a federal court decision upholding the University of Texas and their consideration of race in student admissions. Anna Rima, there has certainly been a long history of complaints about affirmative action as being mere quotas, reverse discrimination, lowering the standards of an institution to admit unqualified minority students, and we've all heard that. How do you respond to the notion that efforts to make a university diverse would somehow lower the standards and penalize or punish people who otherwise might have a seat at the university or a desk at the university as a student?
Well, there are a lot of myths about the ways in which admissions and race is considered in admissions. And so some of those myths are that quotas, this is all about quotas. Quotas were ruled to be unconstitutional many years ago, and they were, they were said to be unconstitutional again by the Supreme Court in the Grutter case in 2003. So universities can't use quotas, and they don't use quotas. It would be a pretty direct and probably a rather easy victory for someone to say, that if a university said, we're going to have 20% of this type of student, by race, that would be something that would be challenged and probably taken down pretty easily. But to your question about qualifications, what we see around the country is that that there isn't a worry that the students who are getting into universities and law schools are not qualified. That what we're seeing at Texas and other places is that you have a pool of qualified applicants, and who among those are able to attend the university, that that there's a lot that goes into sort of what qualified means and what kind of, you know, what kind of qualities do you want a student to have and to bring to campus. And, you know, the African-American students at University of Texas are doing well, and in general, in specific, I think that a lot of the concerns they have are about being isolated and not being comfortable on campus and what that effect is for them. But, you know, there is very little to the argument that, you know, that people who are unqualified are being, you know, are seeping into our university systems. You know, I think it's more that there are lots of qualified applicants, and trying to promote a diverse student body and make sure that you have students of different racial backgrounds just adds to the kind of great environment that students who are qualified of all different backgrounds are able to partake in. You know, what we see in all of these cases is that, you know, for those two white students who are studying in Texas, if they're saying our grades or our GPAs or something like that are higher, there are plenty of white students who are also getting in who had lower grades and lower GPAs. So, you know, that's not what university admissions is about, meaning there's not one thing you can look at. And so to say somebody's unqualified, you know, it's admissions are too difficult and too competitive these days to really think about someone sort of being unqualified to be part of a university community once they get through that process.
And Arima Margav, I wanted to ask you about the evolution of reverse discrimination cases since the Bakke decision. I don't even remember the year that came up, but that was certainly maybe one of the more prominent cases about so-called reverse discrimination. 1978. Thank you. But how have things changed? Because there's certainly a lot of conservative organizations around the country that are constantly challenging efforts at diversity and, you know, claiming reverse discrimination. Has a lot changed since the Bakke decision in terms of their approach at undermining what could be called affirmative action or efforts at diversity?
I don't think much has changed. You know, the same legal organizations, the same conservative legal foundations who are bringing these cases, you know, same thing occurred in Texas in this case. It's a pretty typical actor who's bringing in the cases. And what the differences are, I think, is that, you know, the Supreme Court has changed, and the courts in general and a lot of portions of this country have changed. But also that, like, you know, we're seeing increased competition in terms of who's getting into colleges around the country. I think that the concern and the preparation and how many activities you need to have and the kind of background, the strength of your background, it's becoming ever more difficult to get into professional schools and to get into college. And what we see with that is, you know, more fear about, like, you know, that it's, you know, this is something that's a zero-sum game. One student gets in and another student may not. And so, that's where we see the fear and the concerns about, you know, why is it that all of these students who hadn't had a chance before or not, you know, not typically the students who were going to these universities are having this kind of opportunities and that we may not have that opportunity for a lot of people. And that's where we're seeing sort of more of the reverse discrimination cases. You know, essentially it has become very difficult for minority students or, you know, low-income students to bring a case saying, you know, some part of the process is unfair to them. And we've just seen that space filled by white students who are using, you know, sort of what were laws put in place to protect people of color have used those laws in a very different way, which is to try and say, like, let's shut down any efforts to try and bring in a more diverse group of people to try and make sure that universities are more open.
Arima Margav is our guest, assistant counsel at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. And again, talking about a federal court decision on the use of race in considering admissions, specifically at the University of Texas in this particular case. And Arima, is the University of Texas at Austin unique among universities at working toward diversity, or is that pretty common among most higher learning institutions across the country?
You know, it's different and different across the country, but there are many institutions that try and promote diversity in different ways, and they define diversity in very different ways. And so, in some places, it may be that, you know, if they're a whole university that wants to bring in students from urban environments. I mean, it may be that, but if the question is sort of specifically about racial diversity, yes, we do see that there are universities around the country who are trying to bring in a more racially diverse student population, particularly because, again, we're seeing, in some place drastic shifts in what the high school population is within a state. And so, for example, in Texas, you know, it is nearly half African American, Latino, and Native American in terms of who's graduating from high school today. And so, in terms of what the leadership of the state of Texas is going to look like, how students need to be prepared in terms of who they're going to be interacting with. I mean, I think that's dramatically changed, and universities are taking account of that, which is, you know, part of their role is really to prepare the leaders of the next generation. And part of that preparation has to be that we are living in a more diverse society. We are part of a global economy, a global arena, and one of the ways in which they provide a quality education is one that prepares students to be able to work and live and interact with people who are different than themselves. And so it's in that context that we see universities really sort of focused on diversity and the importance of training leaders in a diverse environment and making sure that their admissions and other policies support that.
What is the meaning of the word critical mass at the University of Texas? What does that mean in this particular context?
I think there's been a lot of talk in the case about critical mass and whether there's a number that could be assigned to sort of whether or not, when there's a critical mass of students of a particular racial background at the university. And I think for the way in which the University of Texas is looking at it is, let's look at our classrooms and let's look at our campus and see, you know, sort of what's going on at those levels in terms of, you know, the fact that they have 90% of their classes with 5 to 24 students with, you know, one or no African-American student, they don't think that that's critical mass, and they still have work to do. And so that's, you know, it's hard to pinpoint a particular number in terms of what critical mass is, but I think what they're looking at is, you know, at what point do we get, do we have enough students that we're getting the educational benefits of diversity as we define them, which is in the kind of conversations, the kind of discussion, the kind of sharing of perspectives, and exposure to people of different backgrounds that the Supreme Court and lots of other institutions in the United States, including the military and corporations, have said are so important today.
All right. Well, before you go on Arima, please tell our listeners what you expect, you know, in the Obama administration in terms of what they will be doing to support diversity around the university systems or, you know, the institutions in general in the country. Has the Obama administration really staked out any position there? Are they willing to stick their necks out at all in terms of this issue, which is certainly at times really volatile and can lead to some very heavy debate? What could we expect in these next 3.5 years from Obama?
I think that they're still in the process of considering and looking at these kinds of issues, particularly both at the higher education level and at the K-12 level. I think that the Obama administration understands that disadvantage comes in many different forms. And so we've heard the president many times talk about class in addition to race, and that, you know, that you have to look at sort of the ways in which disadvantage accumulates. He is clearly someone who understands the ways in which we continue to have closed doors, and the importance of trying to break open those doors. And so, you know, our hope is that that will translate into, you know, smart and comprehensive and effective ways in which we give universities tools to be able to bring in a diverse population and to sort of unlock the ways in which a lot of privilege and you know, frankly, higher education being one of the extreme privileges we have in a society have been closed off to so many people. And so, you know, I think their focus on trying to get students college ready and give them the support, particularly for first generation and low income students, that they need to be able to stay in college, I think those are all steps in the right direction towards, you know, a more inclusive and diverse student body.
Well, Anurima, how do our listeners get in touch with your group, the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund?
So our website is www.naacplds.org. We also have a blog that's called Defenders Online, which actually has a lot of information about what's sort of going on around these issues around the country. And so either one of those places, there's a wealth of information there, and we'd be happy to hear from folks.
All right. Well, thanks for all your work on this important issue. Thanks for being here to discuss it with us tonight. And we'll have our listeners go to that website, naacplds.org, right?
Yes. Thanks very much.
All right. I appreciate you being here. Thank you. Bye-bye. That's Anurima Bhargava of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. It's 3 minutes before 10 p.m. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. And we have a new program schedule that has just kicked off today. Again, apologies for really no advance notice. Democracy Now! Is going to follow this program, which is new and is certainly something that many people on and off the air here have been looking forward to. So that's a good thing. That's going to be each weeknight from 10 to 11 p.m. Now, at 11 p.m., Free Speech Radio News will follow there. It's been moved from its current or past 6 p.m. spot for many years to now at 11 p.m. So that's happening tonight for the first time. Democracy Now! At 10, Free Speech Radio News from 11 to 11:30. And then I believe Chris Ferriero is here to take you till 3, but I'm not quite sure the schedule is up, but it's in micro print and I can't read it. But hopefully, if not now, in the near future, the new program schedule will be available on the WPKN website. That's WPKN.org, and we hope you will go there and take a look at it. And lastly, if you'd like to give us your feedback, do write to us at a new email address. It's wpknfeedback@yahoo.com, and your comments will be shared with the program director, the general manager, the entire board, and the entire station. That's wpknfeedback@yahoo.com. Just send us your letters, and everything will be distributed, and your voice will be heard. And so with that said, thank you for listening. We'll be back next week, Monday evening. Our program time doesn't change here on Counterpoint, 8 to 10 p.m. We're here every Monday. So thank you for supporting this station, which doesn't exist without your monetary and voluntary contributions. And go to the website, wpkn.org, and that's a place where you can make a secure online contribution. And if you'd like to get in touch with myself or anyone here, you can call the phone number 203-331-9756, 203-331-9756, or write to our snail mail address. That's WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Right now, for the first time in this slot, we're going to Democracy Now! Stay tuned. FSRN follows at 11 p.m.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
None of us can forget how we felt when those winds battered the shore, the floodwaters began to rise, and Americans were stranded on rooftops and in stadiums. Over 1,000 people would lose their lives. Over 1 million people were displaced. Whole neighborhoods of a great American city were left in ruins.
Hurricane Katrina, today a Democracy Now! Special anniversary broadcast 4 years after the storm. The Deadly Choices at Memorial. A major investigation reveals harrowing new details of what happened at Memorial Hospital in New Orleans in the aftermath of Katrina. 45 patients died, some of them at the hands of medical staff who, as one put it, hastened their patients' demise. We'll speak with Sherry Fink, the reporter who spent 2.5 years investigating the story. Then as New Orleans recovered from Katrina, we'll speak with civil rights attorney Tracy Washington in New Orleans. And vigilante violence, at least 11 African-American men were killed in days after the storm, shot dead by white vigilantes.
So many shots hit me in my arm, my chest, my neck, my stomach, and you know, I just saw blood everywhere.
We'll talk to author Rebecca Solnit, author of A Paradise Built in Hell. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Voters in Japan have ousted the conservative liberal Democratic Party, ending 55 years of nearly uninterrupted rule. In elections on Sunday, the Populist Democratic Party of Japan captured a record 308 of the 480 seats in the lower house of parliament. It was the worst election performance for the conservative liberal Democratic Party since the party was founded in 1955. One analyst described the vote is a bloodless revolution, the first transfer of power from one party to another in post-war Japan. Democratic Party leader Yukio Hatoyama is expected to become Japan's new prime minister. He's a longtime critic of Japan's close relationship with the United States. This is Sophia University professor Koichiro Nakano.
The DPJ places more emphasis on Asia. It also places more emphasis on the UN framework as opposed to just following the US line. And so that seems to be the key difference, that they want to say that their policy alternatives are not just to stick to the United States, but they're going to build on the relationship with China, with other Asian neighbors, and also to try to work within the UN framework far more than in the LDP government.
During the campaign, Democratic Party leader Yukio Hatoyama questioned the role of the 50,000 American troops deployed throughout Japan and said he would not renew the mandate for Japanese ships on a refueling mission in the Indian Ocean in support of U.S.-led military activities in Afghanistan. Hatoyama has also said Japan will stay nuclear-free under his leadership and that he'll seek a U.S. pledge not to bring nuclear-armed vessels into Japanese ports. August has become the deadliest month for U.S. troops in Afghanistan since the war began nearly 8 years ago. A U.S. soldier died Friday in a bomb blast, bringing this month's total deaths to 46. Meanwhile, a CBS radio news correspondent named Kami McCormick has been seriously wounded in a roadside bomb in eastern Afghanistan. Al Jazeera is reporting the commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan is expected to request today for the Afghan army and police forces to be nearly doubled in size. General Stanley McChrystal's request came as part of his overall assessment of how U.S., NATO, and Afghan forces are operating on the ground. According to the BBC, McChrystal's assessment suggests the current U.S. military strategy is failing. In his report, McChrystal writes, quote, "The situation in Afghanistan is serious, but success is achievable and demands a revised implementation strategy, commitment and resolve, and increased unity of effort." The military newspaper Stars and Stripes is reporting the Pentagon's canceling its contract with the private public relations firm the Rendon Group to produce background profiles of journalists seeking to cover the war. One journalist profiled was Nir Rosen, who got a hold of his profile. The Rendon Group reported to the Pentagon Rosen's reporting in Afghanistan was, quote, highly unfavorable to international efforts and, quote, mainly negative in tone, portraying the situation as hopeless and doomed to failure. The Rendon Group profile also mentioned Rosen's appearance on Democracy Now! When he stated his belief that the war is unwinnable and that the U.S. should withdraw. Former Vice President Dick Cheney lashed out at the Obama administration Sunday over Attorney General Eric Holder's decision to investigate whether CIA operatives broke the law while interrogating prisoners. During an interview on Fox News Sunday, Cheney described the probe as politically motivated and said it, quote, offends the hell out of me.
Do you, now that you've heard about it, do you think what they did was wrong?
Chris, my sort of overwhelming view is that the enhanced interrogation techniques were absolutely essential in saving thousands of American lives, in preventing further attacks against the United States, and giving us the intelligence we needed to go find Al-Qaeda, to find their camps, to find out how they were being financed. It was good policy. It was properly carried out. It worked very, very well.
So even and, these cases where they went beyond the specific legal authorization.
In response to a question from host Chris Wallace, Dick Cheney defended interrogators who waterboarded prisoners and used electric drills and guns to threaten prisoners, even if done in violation of Justice Department guidelines.
the approach of the Obama administration should be to come to those people who were involved in that policy and say, how did you do it? What were the keys to keeping the country safe over that period of time? Instead, they're out there now threatening to disbar the lawyers who gave us the legal opinions, threatening, contrary to what the president originally said, they're going to go out and investigate the CIA personnel who carried out those investigations.
Appearing on ABC's This Week, John Kerry, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, accused Cheney of having disrespect for the Constitution. Kerry defended the Obama administration.
I think there's a little bit of a tension between the White House itself and the lawyers and the Justice Department as they see the law and as what their obligation is. And in a sense, that's good. That's appropriate because it shows that we have an attorney general who is not pursuing a political agenda, but who is doing what he believes the law requires him to do. And we have an administration, on the other hand, that is balancing some of those other interests.
New details have emerged about how the CIA hired the private military firm Blackwater as part of a secret program to assassinate top operatives of Al-Qaeda. The Associated Press reports Blackwater offered the CIA the services of foreigners supposedly skilled at tracking terrorists in lawless regions and countries where the CIA had no working relationships with the government. A former senior CIA official said Blackwater relied on foreigners because, quote, you wouldn't want to have American fingerprints on it. The website CNET is reporting internet companies and civil liberties groups are alarmed over a Senate bill that appears to permit the president to seize temporary control of private sector telecommunications and internet networks during a so-called cybersecurity emergency. A Senate source familiar with the bill compared the president's power to take control of portions of the internet to what President Bush did when grounding all aircraft on September 11, 2001. In news from Latin America, Colombian President Álvaro Uribe has come down with swine flu. Doctors say he's not considered a high-risk patient. Uribe first began feeling symptoms on Friday, the same day he met with other South American presidents at a summit in Argentina. Reports are he did not infect them. At the summit, Uribe spent hours defending his plan to give U.S. troops more access to Colombian bases, a plan that's been widely criticized by other Latin American leaders. Argentina's president has sent a media reform bill to Congress, saying it would strengthen democracy by reducing the control of a handful of companies that dominate broadcasting. The bill would allocate a third of broadcast frequencies to private companies, a third to state broadcasters, and the rest to nonprofit organizations, including churches and universities. The legislation would also limit the number of licenses any one company can hold and aim to promote Argentine-made music, films, and programs. This is Argentine President Cristina Fernandez.
Esta ley busca consagrar.
This bill looks to dedicate to all of our people the right so that everyone can be heard, so that voices of every man and woman can be heard, whether we like what they have to say or not. Whether they serve our interests or against our interests, it is for all of us.
La de lo que nos conviene y la de lo que no nos conviene a cada uno de nosotros.
Argentina's media reform bills based on